Hi, my name's Russell Norman, and this is a podcast called Read Lots, Write Lots, a podcast for those who love to write. As always, we have a very exciting episode lined up today. Today, we'll be talking with Heather McQuaid. Heather is the co-founder of Futuretonic in the UK and is based in London. Heather works with clients to create useful and desirable products, services, and experiences. She gets a kick out of connecting ideas from disparate fields, including neuropsychology of creativity and business model canvases, to create intriguing mashups that challenge assumptions. Her guilty tonic of choice is single malt, which she might sip with an episode of Queer Eye or Schitt's Creek. Heather was an amateur boxing champion, has published poetry, and can make pasta from scratch. Her current project is writing a screenplay. Over to you, Deidre.
Thanks, Russell. Heather, thank you so much for coming to us all the way from London. What's a nice girl from Erie, Pennsylvania doing in London, England? How'd you get there? Why did you move?
I was just always fascinated with London. I think the first time I'd ever been outside the U.S. when I was 12 years old, and my family went to visit my brother, who was in the service in Germany. And I went to London, and it just blew me away. And I think I was just focused ever since then. Like, I wanted to move to London, so...
Well, you did it. Congratulations.
I made it happen. Yeah.
Well done. Well, let's talk about your influence of Germany that Germany had on you. That was your college major.
One of them. Yeah.
Yeah. You seem to have a good time there in college. While I was down at George Mason University trying to, learn marketing, which is the liberal arts of the business school there. You were racking up degrees in psychology and German language and literature. And then went off to Pitt, which I love. I love the nationality rooms. For those of you who haven't, first of all, I love Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is just a great town. You know, Steelers, Pirates, Penguins, just, you know, great sports town. I'm sure you had a lot of fun there. But just the how much pride they have in their international community. Can you speak on that as being influenced by that?
Yeah, I think what I really like about Pittsburgh is it has those, you know, blue collar roots. With the manufacturing and the steel industry and all of that. And it went through some various, you know, very hard times in the 1970s, as a lot of manufacturing towns did, but it managed to reinvent itself with the hospitals and the universities and things like that. So, but there's still kind of this blue collar core, and you still have that feeling in this white collar. So it's this mix of the blue collar and white collar. And I think a lot of the, hospitals and universities bring in some amazing people from, you know, all parts of the world, which is a great kind of melting pot.
I think that Carnegie money helped a little bit too, but
yes.
I mean, that's why the second tier cities on the East Coast, like, you know, Baltimore and, Philadelphia is probably a first tier city, but in Pittsburgh, they just really love their immigrants and hold to the neighborhoods, you know, Ukrainian, Hungarian, Armenian, and the food and just the culture and the festivals. Yeah. Love it, love it, love it. It adds this kind of that kind of rich tapestry. And, psychology for a major, and certainly you pursued that in your advanced degrees. That wasn't super, it's hot now, right? Because, you know, I think in this postmodern age, we all kind of need our own personal psychologist. But, you know, back in the 80s, that you were kind of ahead of your time. What drew you to the field?
Well, the thing is, I wanted to major in English when I was an undergrad. And my parents said that will come in handy when you're pumping gas. At the gas station. And so I thought, maybe I should try to choose something that's going to be more lucrative. And somehow I came up with psychology, but somehow that is acceptable to them. But it was something that I was always interested in. So I guess it's like, could I make a career out of psychology rather than English? And I think that was like a more likely scenario in my head anyway.
Yeah. And then you find yourself in professional writing, which, you know, I think it's fascinating. So it wasn't an MFA. It wasn't creative writing. It was professional writing.
Yes.
So like editing or obviously not IKEA instruction manuals or Legos.
Well, the thing was, I think it was on purpose professional writing because you could focus within that. So, you know, there are people who came out of that program who are screenwriters now, who are technical writers, who are professional, like business writers, who are creative writers. So it's quite a broad spectrum, and it was very interdisciplinary. So we took courses from the design department, you know, learning how to lay out stuff and tell things more visually. We took courses from the Human Computer Interaction Institute to understand like how technology works and how we could use that, from the business college as well. So it was really, I think it was just a really flexible course. And so you could just kind of define your own way.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the next age of enlightenment. I think, you know, with the STEM being, you know, it seems to be like you have kind of the nerds come and then the hippies show up throughout history.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's about time for the hippies to show up with STEM. I have a lot of students to go off to be engineers because college is so expensive and they want to have a career in, you know, a field that actually has a paycheck. So they take a lot of calculus and physics and wonder why they're depressed when they're juniors. And I'm like, well, you probably need a humanities course to make you remember what it's like to be human. So,
well, do you know the history of Carnegie Mellon?
I'm sure there's a lot of steel money behind both of those people.
it was a combination of Carnegie Technical Institute, where you had all the, you know, the STEM stuff, and Mellon College or Drama Arts, right? So now you've got these two very disparate things together, and it also has an amazing drama department. So. Yeah, I would say if you can combine those things, then you're going to have a happier life.
I agreed. And I think, you know, people who major in writing, I think they're just for a basic level of just logic and thinking. And you know, what a great major to kind of springboard off into any field, you know, law or even, you know, like you said, with screenplay, just, you know, understanding to start to finish and the arcs and what have you. Everyone should be an English major, in my opinion. Let's switch gears here to your love of animals. You kind of dropped that in there, but are you a cat person or a dog person? That's my second question. So fascinating to me. I'll judge you either way, but go ahead.
Well, I grew up with dogs.
Well, you're from Pennsylvania, so that's a given.
Yeah. So I have a fondness for dogs, but you know, as an adult living and having a busy life, cats are just a bit easier to cohabitate with because they don't require as much, you know.
That is the right answer. Thank you. Very good. So when did you, I mean, you obviously are very creative and reinvent yourself all kinds of different ways. When did you decide, hey, guess what? I can write short stories and screenplays. Is that just recent or have you kind of dabbled?
No, I mean, I, you know, for a long time, I was a writer in nonfiction, right? So like doing my best to be really clear, tell complex stuff very clearly. I was sort of pride myself on being able to do that. And I did that for decades in various different guises. And then pandemic.
Right.
I was like, I felt like I wasn't progressing in any way. So I thought, well, what's something I've been wanting to do? And I thought, yeah, creative writing. Why don't I try it? Like what's the worst that could happen? And then I found the Readsy platform in December of 2020. And I thought, well, I'll just try it, right? I'll write a short story. And that's where it started.
Well, and you've been very successful. Let's talk about some of your writing here that I particularly like. Rooted, I think, is just brilliant. I think you hit on every social issue, you know, the arc of growth, progress and decay. You hit on multiculturalism. You hit on indigenous peoples, environmental issues, racism. Gender, everything.
In 1500 words.
Right. And but in a very simple, palatable, you know, way of just kind of having this tree going, all right, people, you know, and just kind of
sort it out, will you?
Right. Exactly. It's like a smart giving tree, you know, for those of you who were traumatized by that book growing up. Rooted, I think it should be required reading. I think it kind of captures the history of this country. And I think people forget how far we've come and how far we have to go. But also this tree just kind of bearing witness of, you know, man's inhumanity to man, but also, you know, man's capacity to love and progress. What prompted you to write that lovely story? Award-winning story.
Sorry, say that again?
Yeah, award-winning. It was
award-winning. Well, short-lived, you know. Always the bridesmaid, never the bride. So, well, I mean, there was a prompt, right? So I think that's the starting point, as, you know, from something about writing a story from something about a tree. And I think I thought maybe I could write it from the tree's perspective, right? So, and the trees, they last, you know, I did some research, oak trees can go, you know, 500, 600, 700, 800 years, right? So what could a tree see in those centuries that's going past it? So basically thought, like, if we think about America and how we think, you know, America started from the indigenous folks all through the pilgrims and so forth, like what that might look like from a tree's point of view.
I think also you give this tree such quiet wisdom, you know, you do it in a very elegant way where, you know, it just kind of bears witness to these, you know, lower creatures, you know, and, yeah. and their silliness, you know, and I don't know. I highly recommend that story. I definitely liked Lorelei. Am I pronouncing that right with my
Lorelei?
Lorelei with my non-German accent. Very good. you know, it's just transcendent, and you kind of pull a Shakespeare, you know, where you take a classic story or a classic poem for this matter. And I'll totally butcher this name. Henrik Heine.
Heine.
Yeah. It looks like Heine, but Heine. Yes.
Right? Yeah. Heine.
That's the educated way to say that. Very good. Yeah. And you take this historical fiction, you make it into a contemporary telling, and it just works. It just works. I think, you know, I always, you know, my students are always surprised to hear that Shakespeare wrote almost nothing original, maybe The Tempest, but you know, he just kind of just did a good job retelling old stories. And so to have this old, you know, feminist take on this, you know, archetype of the classic temptress, you know, the vixen, the Eve, the Lilith, you know, something that is so, you know, the siren, come on now, you know, like it's our fault. and you have in this voice of this 11-year-old girl, every woman who wants to say, come on, man, just knock it off, right?
Yeah.
She's my favorite character, I think, of all time. Just give us a little recap for those of you who haven't read it yet, and I highly recommend this one as well.
So, well, this was inspired by Die Lorelei, which was a poem by Heinrich Heine. And it's something we had to memorize in German class. So it's like it's embedded in my head in German. And then again, it was a prompt about, you know, something taking place on a river. And it just that sprung into my head. And I thought, well, how might that story be retold today? Right. Or what would the viewpoint of it be from even the Lorelei? Like, what is her actual story versus just, you know, some guy saying, oh, yeah, she's a siren. And basically she wants to kill a bunch of people who are. Or going down the river, minding their own business or whatever, right? So, so I just thought of what that story might be. And then I made up a character. Well, I did a little research, you know, Greek goddesses and stuff. And I found Melano, who was Greek goddess of nightmares, ghosts and nightmares and spirits. And I thought, what would it be like to tell the story, like, from her point of view if she was a tween and her mother was actually Lorelei? And so trying to tell that story of, like, you know, the girl on the paddle boat and this old grizzly captain, like, trying to, like, weave this interesting tale about the Lorelei. Yeah. And also using, you know, verse. So I wrote the poems myself, trying to actually integrate parts of the story for the original Lorelei in it. And then there's a twist at the end where, I don't know, I should give it away.
But. Don't give it away. Definitely go read it. It's fantastic, for sure. Now you've heard some of your own writings on you know, some of our wonderful collaborators, Beth Connor, yes, and Katie Kennings, you know, audio dramas, you know, where they put the music and the voices. How did you like that? How did you like that experience?
It was really surreal because I've never heard, you know, my stories, someone else tell my stories. And Beth was the first one, and she did an amazing job of that. Like, really just adding, like, so, because you can read a story and get a certain feeling for it, but the way that she told it with this kind of immersal aural experience was really impressive. And I think she added so many other layers to it, and I was really impressed. And that's actually a finalist. I don't know if you've
Oh, fantastic.
Know that. Yeah, she submitted to the Missouri Reviews Miller Audio Prize in prose. Excellent. And she did a fantastic job. And I was just, it blew my mind away. I'd never thought that you could actually have a story in that kind of format and have it just feel totally different that way. So
it's interesting. Russell read one of my stories, and the first time I met him, he sent me a fan fiction picture. He had done a computer generated piece of artwork. And I was like, that's it. That's the character. And I am notorious for having very little description. I'm all about just action, movement. Everyone's got their vibe. I don't do a whole lot of, like, you know, the color of the hair, or, you know, I don't really get into.
No, I don't either.
I just, you know, I think it's because
we're get to it.
We are raised on, you know, Sylvester Stallone and Bruce, you know, Bruce Willis and Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, just blow up, like Michael Bay, you know, just blow it up and, you know, what have you. And so when Russell would send me some pictures, I'm like, that's exactly what I was thinking. And I think, you know, J.K. Rowling, you know, with her Harry Potter books, the movies were not a surprise because she had the vision laid out. And so when you saw it, it was like, yeah, of course, that's exactly what I had in mind. So it's just amazing how you can tap in to these archetypes You know, like I knew what the sea captain looked like. I knew what the mom, I knew the 11-year-old girl. I mean, it just, you needed so little to express so much. And I think, you know, you use archetypes in a very, very powerful way in the debate as well. I knew both those guys.
Everyone knew both those guys. Oh, it was amazing.
Absolutely. In fact, I just wrote one. I wrote these two college guys looking to go party on a night out. And I was inspired by visiting my son at Florida State University, which is notorious for being kind of a party school. In fact, I shouldn't say this, but I will. Russell can edit it out later. But but they have their own STD. So
that's impressive.
Hey, Russell can edit that out or not. I don't know. Anyway, we went to go see him for a college weekend. And I was just looking around, kind of observing these college students. And I'm like, oh, I have to have just a conversation with no tags, just these two guys looking to go, you know, destroy something like mailboxes or girls' hearts or what have you. Anyways, you've heard about my, you know, Myers-Briggs, of course. I think that came out, you know, when we were in college. And, you know, there's a great test online called 16 Personalities. And I use it with my own students. And I always find it eerily accurate. You know, everyone's like, oh, my gosh. And I'm like, because there's only like 16 of you. You know, you see the same patterns over and over again. And I think that's why, you know, the archetypes are so powerful. You know, you don't need a whole lot to get the experience there. And going back to your Lorelei.
Yeah, Lorelei. That's right.
Okay. I thought about Alfred Lord Tennyson's The Lady of Shalott. I don't know if you remember studying that in some boring English class in high school, but she was near Camelot. She was in a castle, of course, and her curse was that she couldn't look directly into the outside world. She had to look at everything through like a mirror. You know, she couldn't really have direct connection with reality. She had to kind of like look through a mirror. And of course she sees Lancelot, and that's enough for her to you know, go ahead and die, you know, over this wonderful man. And Tennyson said that, you know, at one point that she was half sick of shadows and, you know, living kind of like this lie and kind of behind, you know, these stereotypes and these, you know, these walls. And that's kind of, what do you know about Henrik Heine's, I'm saying Heine. Heine, is that close?
Close enough.
I'm wrong for Russell shaking his head. Give me his name again.
Heine.
There you go, Heine. Oh my gosh. I will not study German literature. But anyways, what was his connection with women? You know, was he kind of proto-feminist? Was it, you know, did he have mommy issues? Well, how did he get kind of delve into this character so deeply?
I don't actually remember. I mean, it's terrible to say that I don't know that much about Heinrich Heine's background. Yeah,
that's right. Russell
probably studied it, but
probably from the STD at FSU on. You can just put that all out. That's fine. He's like, let it roll. But fine. We'll do whatever you want.
Just a moment. I'll Google.
Well, let's ask you some softball questions here, some oddball questions. So I'm guessing you're a reader up there in Pennsylvania and those thick winters, you know, those heavy snows and schools canceled. Yeah. So do you remember the first book that made you cry, that you just resonated with you to the bone and you're like,
yeah, it's kind of embarrassing.
That's but, okay.
Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Yes. It was either that or Where the Red Fern Grows. So that was,
that was a tough one too.
Or Sounder. Yeah. One of the dead dog books is very, very tough there. So when you do find time in your busy schedule, cause you have so many, when you're not making pasta or, you know, boxing or, you know, founding companies in London, do you find that your writing energizes you or are you like wiped out?
I find it mostly energizes me. The thing is, you know how you get in a flow state and hours will just pass by. And sometimes I even forget to, you know, eat. It's like, it's 4 hours, but I missed lunch. I think there's no substitute for that. You just like, you're just pulled along on this thread and you're just going. And even when I'm struggling with a scene or a character or something, I'm still kind of like, so engrossed in it that the world around me kind of fades away.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this earlier. I find that if I go and watch TV, I get bored. It's like, I'd rather go make my own world, you know? So I'll sneak back and go knock out a, you know, 500 words or so, just because it's like, I can make that better, you know, or just kind of
change it around. Yeah, I'm very critical of like when, because I do watch a fair amount of, you know, I don't have a TV, but I watch, you know, streaming stuff. And I'm always critical of like what's going on. Is that realistic or not? Or is that plausible? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to Netflix's development team. I got some notes. I think about 80% of that stuff can go, you know?
Yeah.
Well, have you ever gotten like reader's block, like where you're like, oh, I just haven't read anything in a long time, or a novel or something?
I mean, I guess it's a little bit like that now. I mean, I've been reading a lot of, you know, writing craft books, you know, the craft of writing books and screenwriting and stuff. So I haven't read as much fiction as I normally do. So I guess I'm craving that a little bit. And also because I'm writing so much more now, there's less time to be reading as well. So I feel, I don't know, I'm not sure guilt is the right word, but I just feel like the balance, I haven't figured out the balance yet.
Have you, is there a title in of writing books that really, you found one that was really good?
So two books that I think really changed the way that I think about writing. One was The Elements of Style.
Strunk and White.
Yeah.
Online, free, at PDF.
Yeah. It's great. It's just, it really changed the way that I thought about writing and how I could, you know, make my writing even clearer and more impactful. And the other one was On Writing by Stephen King.
Yes. Excellent. He's great. Yeah. Omit needless words. That's pretty much all you need from Strunk and White. And then, you know, just Stephen King having that great conversational, you know, big brother arm around the shoulder, you know, and I think he, you know, he, in reading that book, it made me feel like, you know, basically whatever I'm feeling is not different from the human condition, that, you know, whatever you're experiencing or have ruminated over or you're struggling with, you can connect with someone on that, if not everyone, because everyone kind of has the same stuff there. Great.
Yeah.
So
he had a section in his book where he kind of mocked up like some feedback that he got from something he submitted. And I think that was like so amazing. And I think that that's such a good potential teaching tool, like how you see the difference between something that's okay, which something that's really good by just a few edits. And I think like that actually was, I love seeing examples, right? Because now I can compare it to my own work and move forward.
It's really a miracle. I mean, you have 26 letters, you know, a dozen or so punctuation marks, and how they're arranged is either musical and gripping and page turning or just thick.
Dire.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, a lot of kids, when I grade their papers, I'm like, yeah, this is a D. They're like, why? And I'm like, I don't know. It just is. Well, can you help me make it better? Not really. You know, just try again. I don't know. You know, if I knew, I'd be famous, you know, so just, but it's definitely a D. Oh, okay.
Right here. Just read this book.
Yeah. Right. I'm not sure. I've kind of ceased to care at this point. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's magic how it happens. It's mystical. So, you know, as you're, you know, thinking about this writing career that you're starting, are you writing to be popular, or are you going to just kind of like write for yourself? Are you going to do like original, or do you kind of want to kind of feed the beast and what people seem to want?
I don't really think about, I don't even know what people want. I'm not even sure I would even answer that question, right?
So I mean, master's in psychology, still a human mystery.
Yeah, I was like, I think when I first started Readsy, and, you know, they were like, you know, stories would get shortlisted, and I would examine them trying to figure out like, what is it? Like, what are they looking for? And I never got a really good, clear answer on what it was they were looking for. And I thought, well, it doesn't matter anyway, because I write the way I write. And
it's so subjective, I think, you know, and I tell the kids, it's like, I could read your paper three different times and get you three different grades. You know, it's subjective, and you kind of can't take it too personal. That said, with your number of stories you've written on Readsy, which is one where you were like shocked that it didn't get more play? Like you were like, well, that one was fantastic. You know, is there one that slipped by that you're like, hey, that was awesome?
I don't know. There's like, I was really surprised. Like The Debate got shortlisted, because I wasn't particularly fond of that one.
Oh, I loved it.
And but it's just like, and The Lorelei, I almost didn't put that on because I just thought this is too weird.
It was awesome.
So I don't think I'm a very good judge. I don't think I'm a very good judge.
is there a character that you conjured up that you were like, oh, I need a long work for them?
Well, yeah, you know, Melano. Melano. So she appeared in The Lorelei first as the tween. And then I wrote several stories using her as a character, either directly in the story or kind of referenced within the story about her. And I had this whole idea that she actually like created this periodic table of the unconscious.
Is this like a Judy Blume character, like in the 21st century? Like if Judy Blume characters had like, you know, like a iPhone, you know, something like, Yeah. You know, and better vitamins or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And could plant seeds of nightmares in people's heads.
Right.
Yeah.
Like Beezus and Ramona and Freud, you know, like all together.
Yeah. All together. All mixed up. Yeah.
It's so great to be with someone in their 50s and know those references. Very good.
Tales so, of a fourth grade nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. Or 55-year-old nothing. So on Readsy, I think you and I have both found some squads. We found some people there that
yes.
that inspire us, that we kind of look for every week. Commenting, or we look for their stuff. How has that kind of helped you become a better writer?
I think just having the community there of because there's genres that I might not normally. I mean, I'm pretty broad. There's not like one genre I focus on, right? But there's some genres that I might read less than others. But because those people are such good writers, I'm drawn to those stories anyway, and I feel like I'm learning something by the way that they tell stories. And you know, for you and I, we both say that we don't do a lot of like explanation or exposition about what people look like and stuff, right? But other people are really good at it, and I could admire that. And maybe I can learn something from it, right? So I'm always looking for like ways that people tell stories, how they play with the genre, how they play with the expectations, and seeing how that might inform my own work and how I can maybe bring in some of that into mine. And then it's just a community of people commenting, right? So there's the support, like the thumbs up. Yeah, I mean, everyone likes that. You know? But there's also the more constructive criticism, which I thrive on. Like, how can I make this better? So I really appreciate that.
Have you met a writer online that you have collaborated with?
Not yet. I think Beth comes closest because there was a level of collaboration when we did the Lorelei as an audio drama.
Right. We had a group of five that we tried to write, like, you know, and it was interesting to kind of write on Google Docs and have like five hive mind go in there and like take a paragraph at a time. It was awful, but it was a lot of fun. It was like, you know, like a Frankenstein game or something. Trying to match five styles.
Frankenstein story.
It lasted for two stories that were all like, and thank you. Nice. Yeah. Appreciate that. So let's take you back to when you're little, because obviously you're super creative and super curious about things. But when was the earliest time you can remember realizing that language had power, that words had power and ideas?
That's an excellent question. I'm not sure. I mean, I think I was always in my own head. Like I feel like my parents like neglected me for a long time. I don't mean that in a negative way.
It was
like
a parenting style of the time. It was acceptable. It was fine.
They left me, not like they, you know, they just left me on. I had two older brothers, but they're much older than me.
Right.
So I was basically like an only child, left to my own devices a lot of the time.
Our parents didn't speak to us. That's okay to admit it. They didn't talk to us after eight. After eight, it was we were on our own. It was, and we're hardy people for that. That's fine. Did they give you a library card? Because my mom gave me a library card and permission to leave the house at any time.
Yeah. My mom was a voracious reader, and I think that had a big effect on me. But anyway, I would just like, you know, just... For entertainment, I just make up stories in my head. I didn't write them down. I would literally just sit and just think and like make up the stories in my head. So
yeah, it's called before the internet.
So it's called daydreaming.
Otherwise, you would Google it and just read somebody else's thoughts. Right. I'm a little jaded at the end of the quarter here. You can tell. But anyways, let's go back to like the idea of what you kind of see for future Heather McKay. About your literary success, what's the goal? I mean, do you have like an objective in mind?
I mean, I guess it would be nice to be published beyond the internet at some point. Like it doesn't even have to be a book, just a story that maybe more people see and resonate with, right? Because I think even though the community on Readsy is great, you know, maybe there's like 25, 50 people who see your story. So I guess having a wider audience of people who like what I say would be nice.
Yeah, there are some of them have put together compendiums and some anthologies that go on Amazon, and that's kind of fun to do as well. Well, do you write a lot from the male point of view? Have you tried to do that more? And if you have, how is that challenging?
I at one point I was looking through my stories because I was just looking like what the difference was, you know, first person, I don't really write in second person that much, first person, third person, and who the main narrator was. And I think it's almost half and half. So I've told like my friends, I guess I have a more male-oriented psychology.
Is it that different?
Well, I guess when someone tells me a problem, I want to solve it.
Right.
Right. And so for, I don't know if we go back on who knows the Mars Venus thing. Right. But it's like my thing is to try to solve things, you know, and other. And I think some people say, well, you should just listen to their problem. Like, I can't just listen to your problem.
Right.
I need to be able to solve it. Right. So
that's a very 80s thing to do. 80s and 90s. We fix stuff. Now they just kind of just listen, which is, you know, that's a way of fixing it, I guess.
So I don't know.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, I mean, I think I can resonate with the male psyche as much as someone who's, you know, I'm not of the gender is. I had two older brothers, you know, I have a lot of male friends growing up. So, you know, and you know, just an observer of the human experience, right? Like trying to understand like what and studying psychology a lot about like how the brains are different, you know, when you're growing up in different things. So I think I was, you know, able to put myself in those things. I don't think it was a particular struggle. Maybe I didn't do it very well.
No, I think if you have two brothers, that's it. That's all you need. You know,
That's enough. I could see all the world of the males in those two. Yeah.
Well, what age type do you like to write in the most? Do you like your little kind of prepubescent teenager there, or your young adult, or your old adult? Which one? What age group do you kind of like are drawn to?
Yeah. I was actually surprised that I was writing so many like tween and teen characters. That was a surprise to me. Maybe that's my current level of maturity.
I think that's the age when they actually, you know, still have hope for humanity before they get too jaded.
I mean, there's so much going on at that age, right?
Absolutely.
The hormones, the learning about the world. So I think it is an interesting age to write about.
Oh yeah, coming of age, like the intensity of the feelings, everything is very, very powerful. How do you get your characters' names? Do they just come to you? Do you research them?
Yeah, sometimes they come to me, and other times, maybe I'm trying to think of what I did. Like Melano, right? I actually I have a book about Greek mythology, right? So I was just paging through that and come across that. And other times, I just try to come up with a name that's like that I think represents the character somehow.
I think it's the way we're raised too, because you know, Colleen is always kind of a negative name to me, just because I knew that one Colleen at seventh grade. So that name is tainted forever for the most part. Well, my last question before I turn it over to Russell is this: what is your writing process? I know you probably look at the prompts, you're kind of conscious up in your head. Do you kind of like map it out, or do you kind of like and do you sit and do sections, or do you just do a paragraph at a time? What is the whole Heather McQuaid?
So I have to say it's evolved. So the first short story I wrote, I just wrote it. Like I didn't even think about it. It just came out. And then a couple short stories after that, it was the same thing. It just came out. I had an idea in my head of very vaguely of what the story was about, but I didn't outline it or anything. And then after that happened for like a couple stories, and then I hit a wall and I was like, oh, it's not coming anymore. Like I need some other way to come up with that. And that's when I started trying to outline things a bit more and coming up with more of a structure. And I was reading about other things. Like I have this, the 36 Dramatic Situations by Mike Figgis book. And so I would I'd page through it and just like select one at random and then just try to write a story about that. So I think constraints help me, like the prompts help me, but I need like an additional constraint on top of that. And then, now with the screenwriting, obviously that's a much larger 1500 words. I'm not sure how much you have to plan out, right? Because it's, you know, it's not that complicated, but like a 100-page script, you better plan it out or you're going to get in some big trouble. So I think my writing has changed, and I'm much more structured and much more thinking about the outline of it before I go in. I haven't really written a short story since I started like deep diving into screenwriting. So it'll be interesting for me to see like how much of that has translated into writing short stories.
I have to add one more question. Why did you get so attached to screenwriting? What drew you in?
Well, I love watching movies and, you know, getting drawn into those stories, and also frustrated when stories aren't told the right way.
Agreed.
So I was just thinking, yeah, well, like maybe, and I got a lot of feedback on my own stories, people saying, you know, this reads like a screenplay. And I think when I'm writing, oftentimes I'm thinking quite visually, like I can kind of see the scene in my head of what's happening. And I thought, well, maybe that would translate better into actually screenwriting, because I think that's a lot of what you have to do is imagine what these scenes look like and be quite concrete about what's going on.
Well said, Netflix development. I hope you're listening. Russell, take it from here, sir.
Yeah, I was just following up with that. What's the goal or aspiration for the screenwriting? Is it, like you said earlier on in your story, it's just like to be a little bit better heard. I mean, is it really targeted? Are you trying to get it published, et cetera, et cetera?
I mean, of course, it would be lovely. It would be great to get, you know, a screenplay actually made. But, I mean, that's a really long process, right? It takes years. So I'm not under the impression that I'll write a screenplay and it's going to be, you know, people are going to be totally amazed by it and they're going to make it, right? I think it would be great. And I think a lot of what drives me is just curiosity. Like, I've never done screenwriting before, so I just wanted to try it. Then there's this whole thing after you write your screenplay about networking and develop, you know, and trying to get your screenplay in front of the right people. And I think that's an interesting process as well. So again, part of it is doing it, but part of it is just learning as I'm doing it. So I don't have any expectations that I'm going to, like, you know, have some,
yeah, cool,
my movie out the next year or something, but it's more just learning as I go.
Yeah. Awesome. Everybody talks about the writer's journey. It's sort of multiple layers to that. And I find that in terms of publishing and how does it all work? I'm just sort of a guy that wants to know how things work, you know, so that's the sort of thing. How does this work? How does this publishing thing work? You know, how does this getting a movie made work? And it, as you said, one of my experiences has been, it's mind-bogglingly complicated, all these different things to it, you know, to get these things out there. But the other question I was going to ask you was, you talked about obviously going from being just a non-fiction writer to writing some fiction. What do you find the most challenging when it comes to writing fiction stories? What's the thing that you find hardest?
That's a good question and a hard question. What do I find
hard? I don't want to put you on the spot per se. It's just like, you know, just.
Yeah. I don't know, really. I mean, I like so much. It's so different in some aspects from nonfiction that I just really enjoy that. I enjoy the challenges. So I don't know. If you say it's hard, it's like, oh, yeah, I guess it might be hard, but I don't see that as a problem.
Right. Yeah. So it's really a case of enjoying the journey, enjoying the challenges is what you're saying. So it doesn't really matter that if it's hard, you know. You said you had writer's block a bit there at one point. Yeah. Well, you were struggling to get the. I mean, maybe that's the sort of the bit that's.
Yeah.
Hard,
I think sometimes, and the reason why probably I didn't do creative writing sooner was that it was always like, what am I going to write about? It was that, what's that initial spark that's going to propel me enough to write 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 words. And I think for a long time, I just thought, I'm not sure I have an idea that I could actually write about for that, you know, for that amount of time. That wasn't, you know, whereas with nonfiction, it's like, no, I have, there's this very specific thing I need to say, I need to describe this process and blah, blah, blah. And I know what I'm writing about there. Whereas with, you know, creative writing, it's like that comes from you. You have to generate that.
But you said from a young girl you had stories in your head, so surely that's not too hard. Breezy prompts obviously gets you started. That's the whole point of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just a little bit of a thought process. But it's
those were the stories of like an 8-year-old, right?
So hey. Stories, man. Or stories.
Write about like flying horses and stuff.
Oh, go nuts. So. Deidre, I think we've gone over our allotted time, but it's been great to talk to Heather here.
Heather McQuaid, we appreciate you so much.
Got that beautiful.
Thanks for dropping by. We look forward to following your career.
Got
so
that
much.
Beautiful mid-Atlantic accent too. Thank you, Heather, for coming in.
We'll see you on the boards.
We're a little over time on this episode, so thanks for sticking with us. We'd again like to thank Heather McQuaid for coming on the podcast and providing some insights into her writing. Coming up in the next episode, we'll be talking to Jonathan Blau, all the way from South Africa, another great short story writer at Readsy Prompts, so looking forward to that. If you would like to provide us some feedback or come on and have a chat, we'd love to hear from you. You can get in touch with us at readlotswritelots.com. Well, that's it for this episode. On behalf of Deidre and myself and the entire team, until next time, thanks for listening and bye for now.